Welcome to the Create the Future with Rick Williams podcast. Conversations with leaders who made difficult decisions and built lasting legacies. I am Rick Williams. I speak and write about how leaders can be more successful. My best-selling book, Create the Future, is your essential guidebook for making difficult decisions. This podcast is an opportunity for me and for you to hear how leaders with a wide variety of backgrounds have managed the challenges they faced, made difficult decisions, and had courage when going forward is tough. You will learn important lessons from other leaders. You will find that engaging with our 30-minute conversation will be a great investment of your valuable time. So let's get started. Welcome to the Create the Future podcast. I'm Rick Williams. The Create the Future podcast is a forum for leaders to share their stories about leadership and making difficult decisions for their company and any organization, and in some cases for themselves. My goal is to share these stories about leadership and making tough calls to the broader leadership community so you will be a more successful leader of your organization. We have a great guest today with a compelling story to tell. You will hear about lessons learned and what they experienced. So I'm excited to introduce you to Tom Dorley. Tom is the CEO and chairman of Sage Partners. Tom works at the highest corporate levels with corporate strategy, culture, leadership, and governance. So Tom, in the interest of full disclosure, Tom and I worked together at Arthur D. Little a long time ago, probably longer ago than either of us want to admit. And this was when I was learning how to be a management consultant, and we've remained friends since then. So Tom, welcome to the Create the Future podcast. Introduce yourself and tell us about your journey up to this point.
Sure, happy to do it, Rick. And I do recall fondly, I would say, those times together at Arthur D. Little, where I learned also how to be a management consultant. So I started off my my formal career as a chemical engineer, getting my degree from Penn State. And much to the chagrin of my professors at Penn State, all of a sudden, I got attracted to business school. So I went right to business school at Columbia, studied marketing. And you know, even though I had a good time at Penn State, and the engineers say, wait a minute, what is this guy doing? But I was actually at the time creating my future, which is what this is all about. And so I started off, worked at this business called Arthur D. Little, coming out of graduate school, which at the time, as you know, because you were there also, management consulting was a new thing. And it was a kind of, nobody had a big organization. I mean, McKinsey was the largest, but I don't think they had 10,000 people. Arthur D. Little was the second largest, and we had about half that many. So it was new and all that sort of thing. But I liked it, and away I went, and I did it. I then became an entrepreneur because I left Arthur D. Little to set up my first company, Braxton Associates, which I then merged into what became Deloitte Consulting. And then at the end of sort of a period there, Deloitte pointed out that you got to retire at 60. And I said, wait a minute. As you know, you weren't ready to retire at 60, wouldn't have been, and I wasn't. So I set up this thing called Sage Partners, which is, as you point out, a strategy and governance advisory firm. There are 18 of us who are all experienced. I used to say late career, and then some people found that to be offensive. So I now say we're experienced, right? And that's the way it is. And so in doing so, as I've looked back, and I reflected on this because I read your book, and I got prepared for the podcast, and I said, actually, oddly enough, I was kind of feeling my own way and I was creating my future. And I learned some lessons from it, which I'd be happy to share with you all.
Well, that's great, Tom. I will just share that I'm having great joy having this conversation with you because of our longtime friendship and knowing each other and staying in touch with each other as our careers have gone on separate paths. But I know that we've kind of followed each other from a distance. So I know you wanted to talk about a couple of very challenging decisions you had to make in your career and also perhaps in your own personal life. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that and get us started?
Sure. And so let me just a little bit of context for it. And that is the fact that what you're talking about is creating the future. And I do a podcast and organize our theme right now around what I call navigating the fog of change, which is to say there's so much going on today that it's confusing. The metaphor is the fog of war. And so I put that in the context of what you're saying and what we're doing as a way to bring these ideas together. So then with that context, let me sort of jump in and give you two examples. So one is going to be personal, and it comes from Arthur D. Little, where you and I were there together. So at the time that that I was sort of in the concept or in the contrast of figuring my way forward, I was in my early 30s. And I really liked Arthur D. Little. It was a good place. The culture was great. We felt comfortable. I was learning how to be a consultant. I had a group of maybe 8 or 10 people that I actually managed. I had my own clients. I was developing leads and selling work, and it was just great. And I thought, man, I could do this forever. Which, by the way, and not with Arthur Little, but it turned out to do. And if you remember, the chairman at the time, the CEO at the time, well, was John McGee. And so I had lunch with John one day, and I said, John, what are your plans for the future? And I figured he'd give me one of these vision-y things, right? Oh, it's going to be this and that. But instead, I was wrong. He said, listen, he said, I believe management consulting has peaked. I'm going to find ways for us to invest in non-consulting businesses, and we're going to take the money we make, the profits, the cash flow we make in consulting, and we're going to plow into these non-consulting businesses. And I thought, oh, wait a minute, holy cow. I'm going to be the cash cow at 31. I'm going to be a cash cow. That doesn't sound very good. And I also thought he was wrong, and that was true too, because management consulting hadn't peaked. I mean, Boston Consulting Group was barely 10 years into it. Bain was only 5 years into it. McKinsey was doing fine. I thought he was wrong, and I was right. And then secondly, and you know this, how will these guys manage non-services businesses? I didn't think it was possible. But it was a difficult decision for a lot of reasons. I didn't conceive of myself as an entrepreneur. Secondly, my wife's mother just moved in with us. Her husband died, and so we bought a new house, a big house in Wellesley. So big mortgage and all that sort of thing. Two young kids, and I thought, oh, my God, what am I going to do? But there were a couple of things that I felt. One is I looked around, and I thought, the time is good for being a management consultant. Lots of activity, lots of clients, all of that. Secondly, I thought I was pretty good at it. And so I could do it somewhere that wasn't just under the Arthur D. Little umbrella. So a couple of points there. One is it's important as you're thinking about the future to sort of have your arms out there, have your eyes out there, and be trying to understand what is actually happening that could be good for you or could be a challenge for you. And then secondly, if you're going to make a jump, make sure that it's something that you think you can do. And I thought I could do it well, and it turns out I could. But that was key to me, and it really surprised me because I just thought I was going to be at Arthur Little for, I don't know, for a long time. And it worked out. So it's important to understand when you're in an environment, is this going to work for me, not just today and tomorrow, but for the next year or so or whatever, so that if the signs aren't, that it's going to be good for me, going to have a fun time to make a change. And it's really important to do that. And I did that.
Tom, talk about how you made this decision. Cause you were, you're jumping into something that you'd never done before. You'd never started a consulting company or any kind of a company.
No, that's right.
What did you, I don't know, have a little group of people at Arthur D. Little at ADL, as you and I would call it, or your wife or outside advice? How did you go about actually making the decision to actually do this?
Yes, I did have some outside advisors. The people at Arthur D. Little scratched their heads and couldn't figure it out, so they weren't much help. They were help in sort of understanding what I wanted to do, but not in giving me any advice. And I also talked to folks at some of these other firms, BCG and Bain, which had gone out and done this before. The couple of other fellows who had left Arthur Little, who set up a little company called, what was it called? I don't know, but it was a four-person firm, but they were doing all right. And then here's something kind of interesting. My mother-in-law gave me the thing. She gave me the push over the edge, which was good. She said, listen, she said, if it doesn't work, you're young. You can recover. And besides, we can all go live together in a 3-bedroom apartment somewhere and we'll be just fine. So she gave me the confidence. But the point was, just like what you said, I tried to find people who had who could help me, so give me some advice. I had a friend actually that I met who was a Harvard Business School professor, and he was an advisor to me, part of a shadow or kitchen cabinet, a group of advisors, which I've done all the time. And so I wanted to make a couple of things. I needed some downside protection. So here's what I also did. Arthur Little said, Lee, you're important to us on a couple of projects. Could you keep working? I said, fine. So that was good for me. It gave me a little bit of cash flow on the upcome. And then the second thing was that I had a major client that I brought in, a specialty chemicals division of W.R. Grace. And I said, listen, ADL, this is my client. Do you understand I'm going to take him with me? And they said, okay, because if I left, they were not going to go work for Arthur D. Little. So again, I managed to have a little bit of protection there, a little bit of cash flow from continuing to work on Arthur D. Little assignments, and a client that could be a baseload for us going forward. So I felt, but your idea was, you're exactly right. It's helpful to have somebody outside to say, pat you on the shoulder and say, wait a minute, are you sure you're ready for this? Or to give me some advice that says, yeah, I was ready for it. Yeah.
Well, Tom, I'm going to ask you to think about your experience doing this in the context of the leaders in larger companies that I know you've worked with.
Yeah.
Because what I'm basically encouraging leaders of smaller and mid-sized companies is to, when they're facing a really important challenge or decision, to slow down a little bit, take time to really talk to their team members, to their advisors, maybe some inside, some outside, and take down what often we have our barriers up to the possibility that our own thinking might be wrong. Take down the barriers and listen to other people and get their advice, including your mother-in-law, which sounded like it was a key piece of advice in this.
Yeah.
But think about leaders you've worked with in large companies, and are there any? And it may be that they're no different than you were at the age of, what, 31 or whatever it was, in trying to figure out what they should do for their company. But I'm trying to draw lessons that other people who might have a 30-person firm or a 50-person firm or a 100-person firm could use in their own thinking about how they make decisions.
Exactly. So I'm going to go now to a example just like that. And after we had merged our firm into what was to become the Deloitte, Braxton into Deloitte, it was at a time where consultants could work for the audit clients. And a fellow in Seattle had a client. It was a young company. This goes back decades, but it's relevant. A company that had about 100 employees or so, maybe 125, called Starbucks. Howard Schultz had set this company up, and he had several, maybe 8 or 10, retail locations in Seattle, also in Portland, and also in Spokane. And it was a time back in the late 80s where Japan was hot. And he was thinking about what to do. And he said, hey, can you come in and help me advise? I was brought in by the audit partner, whether or not this potential opportunity in Japan would work for us, because they say they can take us to Japan and we're going to be in this wonderful opportunity, and it's everything's great in Japan, art of Japanese management, and Toyota's building cars that they couldn't build in Detroit and all that sort of thing. It was a wonderful time to be in Japan. So he said, I want to do that. Help me figure out whether this is the right person. Now, key here is that often, as you know, as a consultant, the question that the client asks you is often not the true question. And his case was, so we looked at it, evaluated it. The company in Japan was terrific. They had resources. They had good locations. They could put it in there. But I asked Howard a question. So tell me about your business, right? Tell me about the concept of your business. Remember, there are about 125 people. You know, maybe they had 20 locations. He said, yeah. He said, I want Starbucks to be the third place. Well, what is that? Well, the first place is where you live. Second place is where you go to work. The third place, I want to be Starbucks. And at the time, if you remember, there was Dunkin' Donuts, and there was places like Chock Full of Nuts. Nobody ever stayed at the third place at Dunkin' Donuts or Chock Full of Nuts. You grabbed your coffee and away you went. So he was doing something unusual. And I said, and later when I wrote a book called Value Creating Growth, I conceptualized this as Do you understand your valuable formula? What your valuable formula is, all those things that go into making your thing successful. I said, Howard, I'm not so sure that this thing's going to work in Japan. Hell, it only works in the Pacific Northwest, which is a strange sort of place, right? It was the time of grunge bands and all that sort of thing. And I said, who knows what's even going to work? He said, wait a minute. I'm opening up a shop in on Main Street in Santa Monica, and it's going to be great. And I said, okay. Now, meanwhile, Howard and about five of his people were going over to Japan for a week. Everything was sort of shut down in Seattle because at the time, no cell phones, all that kind of stuff. It was terrible. And I got a break. So I can give you the principles, but let me tell you the break I got. And so sometimes it's helpful to be that way. I had a client also in L.A. I was living in staying in a hotel in Santa Monica. The sign said on the Starbucks shop, and this is February, opening March. Then the sign said opening April. Then the sign said opening May. They finally opened in June. I said, Howard, it tells me that you don't have a thing, a valuable formula, not that I called it then, that is ready to go. And before you do something dramatic like going to Japan, you have to make sure that the thing you're doing works. And so the thing I helped him understand was, and he didn't like it, by the way, because he really wanted to go to Japan. Can you imagine being on the cocktail circuit in Seattle in the 1980s saying, hey, look, my shop is in Japan and they're selling well and all that. But I said, who knows it's going to even work in Santa Monica, let alone in Tokyo or Hokkaido or something like that. And fortunately, they listened to me, and I convinced them that it would take about 5 years or 6 years before he really knew, before he could do that, and it worked. Now, he was not happy with it because that's not the answer he wanted. But here's the principle. The principle was that, first of all, you have to make sure you have a thing that you're doing which can travel. So if you want to expand it, make sure you actually have what I came to call a valuable formula. Then secondly, make sure you have the capability, enough people, enough resources, enough assets to do it. And if those things are in place and if the market conditions are okay, then you go do it. But it's like you said, I got him to, as you said, catch it, take a breath, take some time, slow down a bit. And I do think that if he had gone to Tokyo, then it would have been pretty disruptive because there was a competitor in Oakland called Pete's Coffee. Same kind of idea that coming along. And I think Pete's might have just beaten them if they hadn't taken the time to catch their breath. And so the answer is not that you shouldn't take risks because you need to. And if you're going to be somebody who is building an enterprise that has legs to it, it has to grow, right? And so the leader has the intention and the requirement to try to put the pieces together and say that, do I have a thing that is good beyond where I am now? And if it is, how to make it work? And it's hard for a leader to do that. You could argue this old shiny object thing. Tokyo was the shiny object, but we helped them not get distracted from it, and it was good for them.
Tom, first of all, it's a fascinating story about how that leader of Starbucks, founder of Starbucks, was trying to figure out what his real business model and value proposition was. Yes. But I'm wondering, was he, you said he didn't really like the feedback because it wasn't what he was initially thinking. But what was the dynamic of this? Was he coming to you and said, Tom, I'm thinking about this. I really want to bounce this off and see what you're thinking? Or are you saying he had hired you, had you come in and help him on some other issues? I don't want to try to define what they were. And you said, hey, now that I'm hearing what you're doing, you took the initiative. What was the dynamic there of your interplay that developed this process of forcing him to think more clearly about what his value proposition was and what he was doing, whether he was successful at doing what he was already trying to do?
Right. Well, the question he asked us to address was, is this group in Japan good enough? Do they have the right location? Do they have enough capital and all that? So that was the question. So I want you to answer that question. But in doing so, I said, Howard and his team, help me understand who you are, what you're doing. So he actually visited a coffee roaster, and he talked about how he roasted the coffee to be Well, a little bit on the bitter side. It was a harsh, a stronger coffee than you got in Chock Full of Nuts and all that. So I began to understand what his business was. I visited their landmark location in Seattle and saw how the baristas worked. And these were, by the way, kind of crazy people. They were sort of like they could have been guitarists in Nirvana or something like that. That's the way they dressed. And I thought, whoa, okay. And then he talked about this idea of the third place, which was just forming in his mind, that this wanted to be the third place. And I thought, gee, that's pretty interesting. But nobody's doing that now. So we had to make sure, and I talked to him about trying to make sure that that was a thing that would travel. And as I said, I got lucky because it didn't travel very well, or very fast, I should say, in Santa Monica. Eventually it worked, but it took him, 6 months to get somewhere that should have taken him 30 days.
So let me challenge you with this. So I wrote the book Create the Future because I wanted leaders who are, don't have a big consulting budget to go and hire somebody like you or me in my former life as a consultant, to have some of the principles and tools and guidance as to how they can make better decisions for themselves. What, based on your experience, kind of what are you saying? What are you recommending that leaders in that position, they don't have 50,000 or 100,000 or 500,000 or whatever it is cost to buy a consultant these days, a Deloitte consultant. What do you recommend that they do when they face a tough decision? I'd like to hear it from your perspective as somebody who's out there saying, gee, I can come in if you got can pay my consulting fees, I can come in and help you make better decisions. But what are you saying to those people who don't, who can't pay for that?
Well, that's the essence of Sage Partners, that we are not Deloitte or Arthur D. Little back at the day where there's this pyramid, right? So you got one leader, whatever, and six, seven, eight, nine, 10 people that you have to form. And so the Deloitte team or BCG's team is a $1 million team. It's not even a $100,000 team. So clearly, a company like that can't. But what we have is teams that are like two of us, maybe three of us, who are senior people, experienced people, and we get to the answer more quickly. It's so there was an article recently in the Fast Company magazine, and I talked about how with AI, you can get a lot of done with small teams. Well, we believe that works in us as well. With AI, with a lot of research, we don't have to hire BAs, business analysts to do. We can do it ourselves or have the client do it because of AI. And so it takes the cost of the advice down substantially. But our argument is you still should be, if you're making a serious decision, you still should have somebody to help you figure it out. I mean, I certainly believe that. And you believe it too, I'm sure, and that's why it is Sage Partners is in business. So it does cost some money to do it, but when you look at the downside, what would happen if they're wrong? Then you're paying even $50,000, and you don't pay it in one chunk. You pay it over a period of weeks or months or something like that. Is an expenditure that is worth it. It is an investment, has a high ROI. And yes, but sometimes a client just can't see his way past it. So we call those people non-clients. But it certainly is important that anybody who's going to make an important decision should bring somebody in from the outside. All along, as I was building my companies, including Sage Partners, I've had this board of advisors, people I could talk to, we're not paid and all that sort of thing. I take them to lunch or dinner now and again, but I tell them what was going on and ask them for their opinion. And so it's that kind of person, somebody who is more of an advisor as opposed to a leader of a 10-person team, digging in and analyzing all kinds of things. So it's amazing what you can get done with a relatively small team if they are experienced, So everything is new today. Right. But also it has its tendrils back in the past. And it's kind of what you do and how you feel and how I feel that in a sense I've been there, done that. And so I can bring those experiences reshaped for today's environment of technology and demographics and geopolitics and all that sort of thing, right? But still there is a value to the experience that we all have. And so I'll tell you one little thing. So then I'll let you ask the next question. So a friend of mine has a son, a grandson, who works for Deloitte as a business analyst. And he was saying, on my teams, there's nobody over 27 because they don't know what's going on. And my reaction is, okay, right? And I'm sure that person can make AI dance more than I can and sort of deal with social media more than I could. But having the answer, as you know, is only part of the deal. Now you've got to get the people on the other side, the client, to accept the answer. And that requires experience. That requires sort of understanding how to interact with a senior leader who is, well, like Howard Schultz, want to do something he shouldn't have done, right? Or at least shouldn't have done at that time. And so there's an advantage of young people and their inexperience and their freshness and their use of technology and all that sort of thing. But there's incredible advantage to being able to say, how is this going to work once it's implanted?
So, Tom, I'm going to take a little bit of a diversion here
Sure.
because just talking with you reminds me of a Arthur Doolittle story that I think is worth sharing because the people who are listening to this, I think, will gain some value out of the Paul Sanderson story. Now,
Yeah.
you and I, I'm going to say this because you and I know this, but for people who are listening. So you and I both worked for a guy named Paul Sanderson, and
Yes.
somebody that I have a very high opinion of. I know you do as well.
I do, yep.
And so Paul built the section that both you and I were in up to something like 50 professionals. I mean, it was one of the largest
Yes.
professional consulting sections in Arthur
And
Doolittle at the
very
time.
profitable, very profitable.
And very profitable. And Paul had a faced a challenge. This was after you had left, but I was still there, in which the original cohort of professionals that were working for him and his section were pretty similar in age. Honestly, I don't even sure I remember what the age was at this point, but it was, let's say, 50 years old or something like that. And they had then brought in a cohort of younger Turks, guys and gals, my age, your age, who were, sort of in a way, the energy and future of the section. So you now had a very large section of people directly reporting to him. And he was challenged by the overall leadership of Arthur Doolittle to say, okay, well, why don't you assign, divide your section up and have some group leaders within the section that have responsibility so that they can focus more in developing the professionals and guiding the business in that section. And the problem that Paul faced was that the people who were the older traditional group, kind of similar in age to where he was, most of them didn't want to do it. And the younger Turks, the guys who were in their maybe early 30s, who were willing to do it, he didn't want to put them in charge of the people who are older than they were. And what happened was that he stalemated at that point. He quit. He wasn't willing, and I wasn't involved in sort of all the back of the, the back dialogue that was going on about it, but I knew that that was the dilemma that he was facing. He couldn't bring himself to make that change within his own section, even though he was highly successful, the section was highly successful, he was widely admired by everybody. And eventually he was forced to leave that his role in order to allow the section itself to grow and develop. And I bring this up as, in a way, kind of a tragic story because he is somebody who is wonderful as an individual, but couldn't make that final move to move his business area of 50 extremely highly talented individuals forward to the next stage of growth. And I know you weren't there, but I suspect you probably kind of know about that history. But it's a sad example of someone who couldn't make that decision, who couldn't make that change and grow to the next stage.
Yeah, I actually am familiar with that because in my when I was at Braxton, the company that I founded, Paul was kind enough to be part of my advisory group. And so we would talk about how you think things, how you manage things, when you need to do this, that, or the other thing. And so I recall that, and it sort of is the challenge, right, of saying that the thing that worked today, it isn't going to work just like that in the future. And so it is hard to be able to do that, and to make that transition, to sort of jump the chasm, as they say. And one of the reasons why later on I took my firm Braxton Associates and merged it into what became Deloitte was that I didn't think, and we were 100 and some people at the time, I didn't, and two big offices, one in Boston, one in London. I didn't think we could continue to be independent. We needed some way to scale. And so one way was to find somebody else to work for the scale. And so we needed to change substantially. Also, the person who was my co-founder wasn't kind of on the same track. He wanted to be doing some other sorts of things. So I needed to find a way, frankly, to move on without him. And so this is another way to do it. But I learned that actually from talking to Paul, because it was an idea to say that we've been great. We've been growing. We've been adding, 10, 12 people a year, all that sort of thing, and all that. And he says, well, wait a minute. We start to think about it. Can you get to be 1,000? Because there are a lot of smallish firms growing like mad. How do you jump the chasm? Or I used to call it the valley of death, right? The business schools call it the chasm, jumping the chasm. I call it the valley of death because sometimes and you need a boost. So we might have done it on our own, maybe. I felt we were better finding somewhere to help us out, which they had some institutional capability. They had some ability to allow us to move to new offices without great expense, all that sort of thing. And so it worked out well. And Paul, surprisingly, I guess he picked up what he didn't do back at Arthur D. Little to help me do it differently at Braxton into Deloitte. Yeah.
So I know you wanted to talk about a business-oriented decision, though, even though I think all we've been talking about is in a way business, right? Is another a difficult challenge you face you want to talk about quickly?
Well, I have a client right now, and I'm not going to mention because they're a current client, who is struggling with a base business in the sense that, and I have one chart that I'm finding a way to bring to them that looks at where their growth is and where they're making investments. And it turns out that they're putting all their money in places where they shouldn't. They're putting them into places where they're struck difficult competitive situation where they don't have the right leaders, and they need to take that money and move it to the place where they have opportunity. And I've got to find a way. I find a way to convince the leader that, and he, by the way, has been the one making the decisions of where the money is going, and he's been wrong. So I'm trying to find a way to help him deal with the problem that says that, ha, I'm on the wrong horse here. I need to find a way to explain how it is I made this decision, because it's going to be soon pretty apparent, because I'm going to have to show the chart somewhere to people that that the resource allocation is wrong. And so I don't yet have the answer, Rick, about how to have the dialogue. Well, I'm starting the dialogue. I don't have the answer to how to get him to accept the fact that he was wrong. Now, it's really interesting to me when you find a leader who can say to people, listen, I don't know the answer to that, but let's work on this, and when I find the right answer, I'll bring it to you, or I'll tell you that I don't have it. So it is a really hard thing to do, because the leader is supposed to be the person with the answers, right? But in fact, the true leader says that I need your help to find the answer, and I need your help to untangle this Gordian knot, as it were. And without us working together, we're not going to be able to do it. And so anymore, the leader who says, I don't know at all, will you help me? It is really the kind of very effective leader. And I'm trying to get this particular CEO. They're a company of a couple of billion-dollar sales, about $3 billion, but they're essentially in a single product market, at least product, different markets. And it's a difficult challenge. But if he's going to create a future that works for his company, He's going to have to listen, and I've got to find a way to break through. Haven't done it
Well,
yet.
Tom, you are singing my song. I feel like I'm going to go have a cup of coffee and just let you talk to everybody instead of me talking to them. Because I think that is exactly your job as the leader is not to be the smartest person in the room. Your
Right.
job as the leader is not to say, I know exactly what to do in every instance, and just ask me or put the problem before me, and I'll make the right decision, and we'll just move on from that. That is not your job. Your job is to bring people around you who will help you and them discover what the path forward is that is the best match to the goals you've set, your risk preferences, and your values. That is your job as the leader. And I think that getting that idea in your head that your responsibility is to create the future by the decisions you make today, and to use your team, your advisors, your own common sense and experience to discover what is the right path forward. That is your job. It's not your job to sort of sit there and say, give me the problem, I'll give you the solution, and then we'll move on. That is, you are bound to, if not fail, be a
No.
sub-performer if that's what you think your job is.
Right. And I like the way you've titled the book, Create the Future. Create is an active word. Create says that if we think about it, if we work hard and all that sort of thing, we can influence what the future is. My son, the one that teaches at Stanford, has written a book called Assembling Tomorrow, which is sort of similar, but it's based on sort of societal effects. But it's the same idea. And I want people to understand that there is a future out there that has pieces to it. It's challenging as hell. There's no question about that. But we can't let it overwhelm us, right? We can't sort of say, nothing I can do. Yes, we can create. So I like the fact that you use a very active, a very powerful active verb in the title. The future is there. Let's go create it.
And as I said, my view is that if you define your job as creating the future by the decisions you make today, that gives you a powerful platform and a tool that will make you a better leader. And I think it's great. So, Tom, this has been a wonderful conversation. I mean, the truth is that you and I could continue talking about Arthur D. Little, the lessons we've learned for hours, and maybe everybody would get bored about it, but I think it's fascinating. I'm just thinking about the story about Arthur D. Little and how it ultimately went bankrupt again for bad decisions by the leadership of the company. It wasn't that the consulting business as a business went bad. So, Tom, let me thank you for sharing your experiences. You've made a valuable contribution to our understanding of the challenges we face every day. If people in the audience want to learn more about you or get in touch with you and Sage Partners, how do they do that?
Well, two ways. Well, one, you can reach me on LinkedIn. If you want to reach me by email, it's t.dorley@sagepartners.net. And we have a website, which is sagepartners.net, which connects to me and to my other partners. And I'm more than happy to share my experience that I've learned over the years. That's one thing I want to do. I want to pay it forward, right? Like you're doing. Let's sort of gather up what we've learned and pay it forward so the next generation can be equipped to handle the future.
That's great, Tom. And I personally look forward to staying in touch with you because I certainly learn every time I talk to you. I want to thank our audience for taking the time to engage with our guests and to learn from our guests. If you have a compelling story to share about making a difficult decision for your company or yourself, think about coming on this podcast as a guest. If you want to do that or learn more about how to do that, go to RickWilliamsLeadership.com, and then go to the Create the Future podcast section on the website. Again, that's RickWilliamsLeadership.com. Remember that you create the future by the decisions you make today. If you have an important challenge before you, slow down and take time to get it right. And yes, have some fun along the way. Until next time, be well. What an interesting and inspiring conversation. I hope you found it as valuable as I did. Thank you for listening. Let me know if you have a compelling story to tell about making tough choices for your organization or for yourself. Coming on my podcast is a way to share what you have learned with a wider audience. If someone you know would be a great guest, please make an introduction. I welcome leaders with a story to tell and important learning to share. You can contact me about the podcast at podcast.rickwilliamsleadership.com. That's podcast.rickwilliamsleadership.com. Please share the link to my podcast with your colleagues. They will thank you for getting them access to these valuable conversations. And finally, please give us a great rating on and subscribe to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon Music. Just search for Create the Future with Rick Williams. Thank you for listening to Create the Future with Rick Williams podcast, conversation with leaders who make difficult decisions and build lasting legacies.